Let's watch this profound little clip from The Jungle Book.
Blue? Blue, get up. Oh, please get up.
Mowgli, try to understand.
Bagheera, what's the matter with him?
You've got to be brave, like Baloo was.
You don't mean... Oh, no. Baloo.
Now. I know how you feel. But you must remember, Mowgli... Greater love hath no one than he who lays down his life for his friend. When great deeds are remembered in this jungle, one name will stand above all others. Our friend, Baloo the Bear.
He's cracking me up.
The memory of Baloo's sacrifice and bravery will forever be engraved on our saddened hearts.
Beautiful.
This spot where Baloo fell will always be a hallowed place in the jungle. For there lies one of nature's noblest creatures.
I wish my mother could have heard this.
It's best we leave now. Come along, man cub.
Hey, don't stop now, Baggy. You're doing great. There's more, lots more.
Why, you big fraud? You poor flasher! I'm fed up!
Blue, you're all right.
Who, me? Sure I am. Never felt better.
You sure had us worried.
I was just taking five. You know, playing it cool. Yeah, but he was too easy.
Good old Papa Bear.
It's going to be a bit dull without the little bloke, isn't it?
Yeah.
All right. Last week, we started our Fight Club series, and some of you have seen that movie called Fight Club, and the first rule of Fight Club was what? Yeah, don't talk about Fight Club. Well, last week we started breaking rules, and we're talking about Fight Club. And we talked about a different kind of Fight Club, the Jesus Fight Club. And we learned last week that the Fight Club that Jesus talks about is far more difficult, and it takes an entirely different perspective. In the clip we just watched, it quoted a passage from the Bible where it says, "There is no greater love than to lay down one's life for one's friends." And that was not original to the Jungle Book movie. That literally came straight from the lips of Jesus. There is no greater love than to lay down one's life for one's friends. This is, in some sense, a very nice message. It feels like, oh, this is, you know, you just put other people before yourself, lay down your life. What a generous thing to do. And I think that in the course of human history, there have been many people that have laid down their life for the life of someone else that they loved. We've heard of thousands of heroes in times of war who've sacrificed their lives for the lives of other people. We've seen parents lay down their life for the life of a child. And in this room today, I believe that many of you, in fact, I would say most of you, would willingly sacrifice your life in order to protect the lives of people that you love. I think that most of you would do that. But I want you to consider for a moment today that the laying down of your life for another is not only done through the physical act of dying or dying physically. I believe that there are many relationships that you have where the greatest need is simply for you to lay down your life in other ways. They don't need you to die. They need you to lay down your life for them in other ways. So we're going to talk about marriage just for a moment here. And if you are not married, I don't want you to check out, all right? Okay, stay with it. Maybe there's some lessons here for the future. Maybe there's some relationships in your life that you can figure out how to apply this to. But for those of you that are married, I want to talk to you today. So many of you, you might say, you would be willing to die for your spouse. Others of you could wholeheartedly agree, I am willing for my spouse to die for me. This willing to die idea is interesting to me. So many people would say they are willing to die for their spouse, but they would be unwilling to admit if they had made a mistake. Like, oh, that's odd. You'd be willing to die, but not to admit you made a mistake. You'd be willing to die, but unable to set aside your own likes or dislikes in order to improve your relationship. Perhaps you're willing to die, but unwilling to create boundaries in your personal life in order to protect your marriage. Maybe you're willing to die, but unwilling to invest the needed time and money into your relationship. Maybe you're willing to die, but unwilling to do personal and internal work to create an opportunity for greater intimacy in that relationship. It makes me wonder, is it just because it's just easier to die than to do all of those other things? When you refuse to lay down your life, some of these things, for the loved ones in your life, you in essence, well, stay with me, you in essence make them your enemies. Instead of you selflessly honoring your loved one, you selfishly choose you instead of them. And when you always choose you, all of the time, it's basically saying, hey, I know I said I love you and I def would die for you, but either we watch my favorite Netflix show right now or I'm out of here, all right? You know, it's my way or the highway. It's this kind of attitude. Now, there are definitely some situations in some very unhealthy relationships that have the potential to harm you. And in those moments, you do, in fact, need to set a boundary that's my way or the highway. Certain things are not allowed to be crossed. But that's not specifically what we're talking about today. I am in a network of relationship with many other pastors and pastors that are my age. And one of our insights as we talk to each other about the modern culture and the needs and challenges of our congregations and what the people are going through, there is a general sense that something has invaded our culture when it comes to marriage. When marriage gets difficult or complicated, it's simply become culturally okay to leave the moment it gets complicated or difficult or hard. And it shows up in different things that we say. One of the things that we say is, well, we just don't get along anymore. You ever heard anybody say that? How come you guys split up? Oh, we just don't get along anymore. Well, can I just say today, that's not a problem. That's just called being human. You put two people in the same house for any length of time, and you're going to have two people that eventually don't see eye to eye. You simply have to work it out. You have to be willing, here's where the passage gets hard, you have to be willing to lay down your life for the other. It's just a lot easier just to physically die than to be willing to work it out, to put yourself in a position where you are willing to get along, where you're willing to see eye to eye, where you're willing to say, you know what, I don't love this, but I'm going to do it anyhow. I don't like this, but you know what? They love it, and so I'm going to learn to like it. These are very, very real things. Another thing that people say is this expression, we just grew apart. You heard that expression? We just grew apart. Now, somewhere along the way here in the United States, we've given people permission to just say whatever stupid thing comes into their mind. This is one of the stupid ones right here. We just grew apart. Okay, I think I understand what you're trying to say, but you grew apart because in life you grow. And if you don't intentionally choose to grow together, you will in fact grow apart. So what you have to do is you have to nurture your relationship. You have to invest into your relationship. You have to go back and say, hey, we grew apart, but it's all right. We can grow together now. You don't just say, hey, well, we grew apart, so that's it. No, you stop, you pause, and you nurture the relationship back together. There is been a lot of discussion, a lot of literature, a lot of communication about what it is that causes the American divorce rate to be so high. And different organizations will talk about different things like money or sex or communication, or they'll just have all these different things that people will talk about. But one leading expert in this field says this. They say, the number one common denominator for divorce in America today is not all of the what people think as obvious things. And I told you this a few months ago, but I will tell you now, and I will tell you again in the future. The number one thing is not having a date night. The number one common denominator in couples that split up versus couples that stay together is this idea of not having a date night. And it seems so simple. And so for all of you that are married in the room today, I would like every husband and wife in this church to go on a date with your spouse, not with somebody else, but with your spouse. Just to be very clear, that would be another whole issue for divorce, right? To go on a date in the next 14 days, somebody say 14, 14, next 14 days, and on that date, I'm giving you homework. Make a plan on how to go on regular dates for the rest of the year. Maybe you're not like me, but I have to have a plan. I have to know that every Tuesday night is date night. And every Tuesday night is date night. 45 to 48 Tuesday nights out of the year, my wife and I, we will go on a date. At this point, the devil, who is not permitted in this room, so I don't know how he does this, but nonetheless, the devil is whispering in your ear, little devil birds sitting on your shoulder, flooding your mind right now with excuses. Like, that's ridiculous. There's no way we could do that. Can I just tell you this? This is not the moment where I come alongside of you and say, oh, it's all right, don't worry about it. This is the moment where I say, all those excuses are garbage and they have to be worked through. No matter how valid your excuses are, you have to figure it out. Money is not an excuse. Dates don't have to cost money. Time is not an excuse. You have to make the time. Your season of life, this is a really, really, really popular excuse. It's just the wrong season. We're in a difficult season, or it's a season of transition. It's a different season of our life. Seasons are not excuses. I don't know if you believe that, but it's true. Seasons are not excuses. And by the way, and this is a side thing, a season is 3 months, not 3 years or three decades. Okay? Season is 3 months. Sometimes you'll think to yourself, well, I don't think, Pastor, I don't think you understand the unique challenges of my life. I don't think you understand the unique challenges of my relationship. Well, on some level, I don't have to understand. You have to understand, and you have to figure it out. You have to figure out how you're going to work through your excuses. I can give you ideas or hints or different things like that, but you're the one that ultimately has to figure it out. Or here's a big one right now. Pastor, I don't think you understand the unique challenges of my children. I have these kids, and they are crazy. No one will babysit them. No, you know, whatever it is, okay? You know, and you know, you have all these excuses, or I can't figure out babysitting, or you have to figure it out. You have to figure it out. But I have a really complicated child, and all kinds of maybe disabilities or challenges. I understand that. I live that. You still have to figure it out. Here's why. In your family, your relationship with your child is not the most important relationship in your life. Your relationship with your spouse is your most important relationship. Your children do not come before your spouse. Your spouse comes before your children. You know, on a plane, when the air mask comes down, they say, put the air mask on you first and then take care of the people around you. That's what you do with your spouse. You and your spouse have to be good in order for you to be a great parent. You could be a good parent and a bad spouse, but you can't be a great parent unless you're a good spouse. So you have to figure this out. And this is just a really practical example. Next 14 days, go on a date, make a plan to go on a date for the rest of the year. Now, I would suggest that you do it weekly. I think it's just automatic. It goes into your rhythm. We all understand what a week looks like. It's 7 days, and you can just pick a day and make it not movable. That's what works for me. For you, it might be a little bit different, but you have to figure it out in your context and in your life. I love you. It's all right. It's all right. Third thing that people say is this. We just don't love each other anymore. Have you heard this expression before? We just don't love each other anymore. This is also one of the top 10 stupidest things that people ever say. Okay? Here's why. Here's why. I got to tell you why. You don't even know why yet. What people mean when they say we don't love each other anymore, what they're saying is that they don't feel in love anymore. Their feeler isn't working the same way. They don't have the same oohs and ahs and butterflies. They don't have the same feels in love. But this is why it's not a very intelligent thing to say. Love is not a feeling. This might be new to some of you. Love is not a feeling. Love is a choice, and love is an action. Love is a choice, and love is an action. Now, so what that means is when you say we don't love each other anymore, we fell out of love, or I don't feel in love, what you're saying is I am not acting in a manner that causes me to love. That's what you're really saying. And again, so that's something you can correct. That's something that you can act towards. If you have someone in your life that you love, but you don't feel in love, here's the solution. Act your way back into love. You act your way back into love because actions always precede feelings. Actions precede feelings. Now, if you go back into this moment when you felt madly in love with somebody, I can almost guarantee it was at a moment when you were spending a lot of time with each other and talking to each other a lot. You were doing stuff, you were active together. And those things shift over time. Life changes, you don't have the same amount of time, and all this kind of stuff. So you have to figure out how to act your way back into love because actions precede feelings. Maybe you don't get this quite yet. Hopefully I can help with this. Most people do not love going to the gym every day. Most people. Unless you're Miguel or Dele, all right? If you're Miguel or Dele, you love going to the gym. Like, you just there all day long, you can hang out, you can have meetings there, and it's great, all right? But most people don't love it. But watch this. After you roll yourself out of bed and like force yourself to get to the gym, and you get to the gym, once you're there and you start to work out, and you force yourself to go through your routine, when you're done going to the gym, you feel like a boss, right? Right? I mean, it's like, woo, all right. Like, I went to the gym one day this month. I feel great, right? It's just, but you feel, you act your way into the feeling of it, and it's a very real experience. Same thing happens in our relationships. There's things you act your way back into. No greater love than laying down your life for another. Today, would you consider that that might mean a whole lot more than just dying physically on behalf of someone else? It might mean dying to yourself so that your relationships can improve. Now, it's one thing to lay down your life for a friend or a loved one, but what about laying down your life for an enemy? Think about this. All your life, you've been told, hate your enemies. Destroy your enemies. Alienate your enemies. Isolate your enemies. Make fun of your enemies. Run away from your enemies. Ignore your enemies. You can't possibly learn anything from your enemies. And this is what you've been taught. This is what you've been told by our culture over and over again. Now imagine this is all the stuff that you've been told your whole life. This picture right here. And imagine that this little pot right here is you. All your life you've been taught, hate your enemies, destroy your enemies, ignore your enemies, harm your enemies. If somebody punches you, punch back twice as hard. This is what you've been taught your whole life. In one way, shape, form, or another. So what do you think is going to happen when you get angry with somebody? What do you think is going to happen when you get mad, when you get frustrated with somebody? What's going to happen in your life is whatever was put into you is going to come out. And it doesn't just magically get awesome. It's the same. What goes into you comes out of you. Now, in your life, somehow, you come to some awareness of Jesus, and Jesus starts to teach you different things. Jesus starts to say things like, you know what? All of this stuff that in your life you thought was okay, that stuff actually hurts you. It harms you. For many of you in the room today, you got here to this moment in your life through your street smarts. Like you survived, you made it. Maybe you come in here pretty broken. Maybe you've come in here with quite a bit of baggage, but nonetheless, you still made it. And so one of the biggest challenges in your life is letting go of your street smarts, because all that does is hurt you moving forward. All of those things that you thought before will crush you in the future. All of that stuff that kind of worked before, now that harms you. It's actually been harming you for a while, but now you're just coming to a realization of it. It's still hard to let it go. So Jesus comes along and he starts to teach you some stuff, a lot different than everything else you've been taught in life. And so somebody is your enemy, and Jesus says something ridiculous like, love your enemies. Lay down your life for your enemies. And that's totally different. And so what would be nice is if life worked like this. Oh, I'm a little pot. Jesus now is telling me good stuff, and now good stuff is coming out. Do you all understand that's not really how life works? How life really works is that your whole life, all this bad stuff's been going in, all this polluted thinking, all this polluted ideas is being poured into your life. Stuff that you didn't even ask for. It just got put in there. As I say a lot of times, it's not your fault, but it is your problem. Okay? So you have to deal with it. Now Jesus comes along, and now Jesus is pouring something new and fresh and clean and pure into your life. It just takes a while for the other stuff to get out, though. It's not an excuse, but it is a reality that while you're working this stuff out, you're going to make a few mistakes. While you're working this stuff out, you got to pay attention to exactly what it is that Jesus is calling us to do. Jesus laid down his life for his friends. and for his future friends, which at the time were called enemies. Jesus laid down his life. He set this example for us. There was a man named Stephen who, after Jesus was crucified, buried in the tomb, rose again from the grave 3 days later, ascended into heaven. So after this moment in history, there was a man named Stephen that was full of grace and power, and wherever he went, he performed signs and miracles among the people. And all throughout Jerusalem, a large number of Jews became believers in Jesus Christ. Basically, Stephen was the food pantry coordinator. And whenever people would come, or whenever he would take food to wherever it needed to go, if someone was sick, he would pray for them and they would be healed. This was a pretty exciting ministry that Stephen had. And so this was happening and people were coming to faith in Jesus, and the religious leaders of the time became quite angry with Stephen, much like they had become angry with Jesus before. And in Acts chapter 7, verse 54, it says, "The Jewish leaders were infuriated by Stephen's accusation, and they shook their fist at him in rage." 57. "Then they put their hands over their ears and began shouting. They rushed at him, dragged him out of the city, and began to stone him. His accusers took off their coats, laid them at the feet of a young man named Saul." Somebody say Saul. Saul. "As they stoned him, Stephen prayed, 'Lord Jesus, receive my spirit.' He fell to his knees, shouting, 'Lord, don't charge them with this sin.' And with that, he died." In this particular moment in history, Stephen is dying for the name of Christ. But his thoughts were not thoughts of bitterness towards his attackers, his enemies. They are thoughts of asking God on their behalf to forgive them while he's being executed. It's really a profound thought. Just think about how horrible this kind of a death was. There'd be people around you, you'd be in the center, and they'd just be throwing rocks at you, rocks large enough that when they hit your head, it would crush your skull, or into your ribs, it would shatter them until you died. This was not a pleasant death. It was anything but. He's dying, and he's dying well in front of his enemies in order that his enemies might have the opportunity to know real love. That's why he chose to die that way. Stephen knew that the very people that were killing him were the very ones he loved and was trying to set free from spiritual blindness and bondage. He loved them enough that he was willing to sacrifice his life so that they might be free. There was a witness there that day. In fact, he was an individual that gave permission and encouraged the stoning of Stephen. One of the top religious leaders was a man named Saul. And in Acts chapter 8, verse 1, it says, "Saul was one of the witnesses, and he agreed completely with the killing of Stephen." Now, if you don't know the story about Saul, Saul, who's killing Stephen, would eventually have his name changed by God to Paul. And Paul would eventually follow in the same footsteps of Stephen and become a follower of Jesus. Eventually, Paul would change the world. He would write most of the New Testament in the Bible. And on nearly every list today of the most influential people in the history of the world, the Apostle Paul is always at the top or near the top. Paul changed the world. But Saul was only able to become Paul because Stephen literally laid down his life for Saul, who at the time was his enemy. There are billions of people throughout history that can trace their faith all the way back to what Paul helped them to understand. But if it were not for Stephen, none of it happens. If it weren't for Stephen, the likelihood of you following Christ today is about zero. Because Stephen is the one that made it possible for Paul to happen. It happened because he was willing to lay down his physical life for his enemy. Verse 55, I skipped when I read it earlier, and I'll read it now as the worship team comes up. It says, "But Stephen, full of the Holy Spirit, gazed steadily into heaven and saw the glory of God." So as Stephen is being executed in this particular moment, the grace of God comes upon him, and he's able to see into heaven. He's able to see Jesus. "And he saw Jesus standing in the place of honor at God's right hand. And he told them, 'Look, I see the heavens open, and the Son of Man standing in the place of honor at God's right hand.'" Now, notice in this passage that when Stephen sees Jesus, Jesus is standing at the right hand of the Father. Now, this might not seem like a very big deal, but every other place in the Bible, when it talks about Jesus being at the right hand of the Father, Jesus is sitting down. Jesus is sitting at the right hand of the Father. This is the only time in the Bible where Jesus is standing at the right hand of the Father. And whenever that happens, you get to ask the question, why? Why is Jesus standing up? I think that at this particular moment that Stephen is looking at Jesus, that Jesus is also looking right at Stephen. He's standing because Jesus is an active participant with Stephen in this moment. Stephen is not alone. Jesus is right there with him. And it might look to everybody around that's stoning him, it might look as though Stephen is somehow losing. But Jesus knows that Stephen is actually winning. I think that's one of the reasons why Jesus is standing. It's also important to note that Jesus is standing because he's actually rescuing Stephen in that moment. Years earlier, Jesus showed up in a fire to rescue three Jewish young men. And in that particular moment, he actually saved their physical lives. In this moment, Jesus shows up once again to rescue. But this time, the rescue will happen as Stephen sacrifices his life. Jesus is standing because he has already rescued Stephen from eternal death. Now, Jesus is right there, ready to welcome Stephen home. And the last thing is, I think that Jesus was standing to honor Stephen. Stephen, in essence, gets the one and only standing ovation from Jesus that's in the Bible. Nobody else gets this. Just Stephen. Just imagine Jesus. Stephen, got it. You understand everything I was saying, everything I was trying to get us to do. You nailed it. The one time Jesus does this is literally for the man who understood this idea of the Fight Club that Jesus runs. Lay down your life for your friends and for your enemies. Why? Because when you do, change the world. Literally, you would have no chance with Jesus if it weren't for Stephen. I'm thankful for Stephen. Can you stand with me? Close. second rule of the Jesus Fight Club is lay down your life for your friends and for your enemies. There's three things I want you to reflect on today. Homework for you today and this week. One, I want you to take a look at your relationship. Are there some mid-course corrections that need to take place? Are there some changes that you need to implement right now, today, tomorrow? Second, I want you to take a look at all the things in your life that have ever influenced you. I want you to take a look at all the things that have poured into your life. The things you think, the things you like, the things you say, the attitudes or the scenarios that have just been poured into your life throughout your life. You literally might need to take a piece of paper and a pen and write down everything and anyone that has ever influenced your life. Then afterwards, go through and compared to what God says in the Scripture, which of those things were good influences and which of those things were bad. When you identify those things which were negative or bad or harmful, it's just the process of identifying what it was and then intentionally rejecting that out of your life. Saying, this was not the way I will continue to live my life. I reject that out of my life. And I will choose the path that Jesus has for me. Third, ask yourself right now, am I living my life in such a way that when I come to the end of it, that I will get a standing ovation from Jesus? Do I get it? Do I understand what He's doing in my life? Am I willing to go all the way? And if you're not, maybe it's time to start living your life in a manner according to that goal. The worship team's going to lead us in this song as they do. The altars are open if you want to take a few moments to pray. In just a moment, I'll come back up and close.